Welcome to the ColorCast. We are the Coloristos, a podcast about color grading, color science, and post-production. I'm Josh Pitok, a colorist for reality TV in Los Angeles.
I'm Jason Myris, a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles.
And I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist and an online editor in New York City. And today we are talking about, I think a subject matter that it's come up a little bit before, comes up on the forums a lot, and it's something that there's a lot of confusion out there about, and that's GPUs. GPUs, the new CPU for computer. So a lot of us use Resolve, a lot of us use After Effects, a lot of us use Premiere, we use a Neat Video, we use all kinds of programs that are utilizing the GPU for doing some of the heavy lifting and the heavy processing in our field. And there's a lot of options out there and a lot of confusion out there.
Maybe we should start off by saying what we use too, like AA, I guess. Hello, I'm Josh B. Talking. I'm a Quadro 4000.
That's actually really funny.
I am Josh B. Talking. I am a Quadro 4000.
I up until just recently was using a GT 570 with really great results, but have moved actually to a 5870, which is giving me OpenCL support in Scratch that I'm experimenting with. So I still love the GTX greatly, but I am seeing where OpenCL could lead and trying out some things with like F65 and Arri and stuff like that.
Wow, cool. I'm all over the place actually, but on the Resolve system now I'm running GTX 580. I'm trying out the classified cards. I have a 680s, I have 570s, I have 480s, I have Quadro 4000s. I've got.
So, Juan, are you using them with a Cubix box as well?
The Cubix box is feeding the Resolve system now, so that's got three 580 classifieds now, and I'm trying those out. And there's a. Before that, I was using a 580 for Resolve processing before the Cubix. And before that, I was using a 480. And before that, I was using a 285. And so, you know, I've been through the ringer in terms of graphics cards.
Yeah, the 285 was like the first big card for Resolve too. Was it classified for?
No,
certified for Resolve or no?
Officially, it was, you know, because the Resolve has a funny thing where, you know, it's been the case that you can, on the Mac platform, you could get PC cards, NVIDIA cards, and run them with special drivers from NVIDIA. But the Resolve config guide did not officially endorse those cards until very recently because they weren't fully qualified cards as far as Apple was concerned. So the only cards that Resolve supported that Apple qualified were the Quadro 4000 for the Mac and the GTX 285, and then before that, the Quadro 4800 for the Mac, which are all kind of, by today's standards, fairly weak cards. They're not particularly strong cards, including your beloved Quadro 4000, Josh.
You know, and the thing is, too, about the Quadro, not that I'm making any excuses for it, but the conversation kind of has to go around how many nodes do you think you actually need as well? It's more of a workflow thing too, because there's other options rather than adding more GPUs too. You could run in proxy mode if you need to. You can
use a render cache.
You can use your render cache. There's a lot of other options that you have rather than just adding more GPUs to your system.
Yeah, for me, I think it really comes down to, are there clients in the room and what kind of work are you doing? You know, if you're doing, kind of a high pressure grading situation, you really need all the performance you can get. And that's why, like, you know, places like Company 3 and, you know, facilities that really, really focus on commercial work, they usually run on Linux boxes and they run with like up to 8 GPUs in their boxes because they just can't, it's about appearances to a certain degree. You know, they can't be dropping frames as they try different things.
Or if you decide you want to work in stereo as well, that's a big difference.
Yeah, actually, I've been able to pull off stereo with a single 580. It's just a question of like, what kind of grades are you doing? But yeah, you can get away. You can get away with, you know, a couple of nodes on a regular GTX system. You know, the things that kill you in terms of performance are obviously noise reduction is the biggest killer in Resolve for GPU performance.
Yeah, so yeah.
If you want to use the noise reducer, you're going to need to either live with drop frames, or you're going to need to go to a Cubics box, because nothing else is going to cover it. Even a slight, you know, noise reduction on a single graphics card system is not going to be able to play back RT. But then beyond that, you know, if you use a lot of qualifiers, if you use a lot of blur nodes, if you use a lot of power windows, all of those things tend to be more taxing than just the regular kind of primary or secondary grades.
Yeah, I mean, I still see pretty decent results with even up to 7 or 8 nodes with a 4000 card.
Yeah.
But the thing is like these days, if I had the choice to make it again, a 570 is like $300. A 4000 still is around $600 or $700. So there really, to me, is no real choice.
I mean, it's just, it's almost like, it's kind of laughable. Like, you have to go like, wait a second, the card that costs 3 times as much is going to give you 1/4 of the performance? It doesn't make any sense. It's kind of illogical. And people are like, this can't be right, but it is.
Yeah. It's because it says Mac on it.
Yeah.
That's pretty much what you're paying for.
Well, no, the Quadro 4000 for the PC costs $600-$700 as well. It's not like that card is significantly cheaper.
But like, how much is a 570? Isn't it like $300 or so?
Yeah, you could, if you can find it.
Yeah.
That's the other thing is, you know, so we've got like this new generation of, I mean, we're kind of focusing on NVIDIA cards a lot, but the, you know, we can get into the ATI stuff as well. I think Jason can probably have some really good insights on that stuff. But you know, with the NVIDIA cards, there's the new platform, which is the Kepler platform, which is the 600 cards, which have so far kind of not been as a gangbuster in terms of performance as we had hoped when they were announced. Because when they announced them, they were saying things like it's got 1500 CUDA processors on board, you know, versus the 500 CUDA processors for the 580. And it seemed like, oh, this card's going to be a tremendous performer. And in reality, it actually hasn't been. You know, it's been kind of on par or maybe slightly behind the equivalent 580 card.
So, Jason, what do you think about the ATI cards versus the NVIDIA cards?
Well, one of the big things that I kind of learned a little bit, what I will say is that I learned an important lesson, at least with Scratch. And, you know, a lot of people are looking for ways to get the most that they can out of whatever software they use. And I did that with Scratch. And, you know, I've been using Resolve a lot. And, you know, up until the very recent past when I've been focusing on Scratch, but I was using Resolve a lot. I was actually doing other things in apps that would take advantage of a GTX. And so I went and I got the GTX 570. I bought it myself and then took it to Dave Parnelli in Hollywood. He's a guy that a lot of people go to for flashing their GTX cards.
MacVid cards, right?
Exactly. Yeah, MacVid. He's quite famous. And he's a really nice guy. Actually, we stood there when I got my card and probably talked for easily 45 minutes about stuff that was going on in cards. And so it was really interesting chat with him.
You know, he's like I think he's a production designer or something like that.
Yeah, he is. He does the GPUs on the side, and he's actually really a really successful, you know, production designer. And he spends a lot of time on that. He got into the cards. It's, you know, one of those classic, you know, got into it a little bit by mistake things. You know, he was attempting to find sort of better video card solutions for himself. And then he ended up selling it, and that's exactly what happened. Is he sold one on eBay, and then it got around just from that. Essentially, he would buy a card, he flashed it. I believe the story goes that he would kind of upgrade, sell his old cards, and these people are like, "Wow, this is a card that's not supposed to be available for, you know, Apple," and, you know, became popular really quickly, and all of a sudden a business was born. And that was actually a while ago. I think he started this, you know, several years ago. I think 7 or 8, maybe even more. But that being said, I was lucky enough to be able to even go meet him, you know, because he's about, you know, 40 minutes away up in Hollywood. And everything worked really well. What I will say about a flashed GTX, at least if it's done correctly, there's a couple things. Not only is there the ROM that is being put on the card, but they actually have to, at least Dave, is soldering on a larger memory chip, I guess, essentially, EEPROM. And he is, yeah, and because the Mac ROM is actually physically larger. I think it's something like over 128K, whereas a PC equivalent is something smaller, you know. So he is going and soldering, doing like, you know, surface mount style soldering is very touchy stuff. So he's, you know, putting a lot of value into what he's doing for your card. He, you know, he charges at least around $100, I think, depending on what card you have. And, you know, if you want to buy the card from him, he can do that. But he also modified my card, which I brought to him. And the thing that's really important is that I would say it's kind of remarkable. You put the card in and it really does act like a actual Apple card. Reboot, reinstallation, the boot screen, boot manager. I mean, all of those things work. The proper referencing of the card in system preferences. But that's where the gotcha, at least for Scratch, I ran into, where Scratch seems to be, you know, very particular about cards. The 570 is not really known to assimilate because they're using Quadros and then they're using the ATI card. So on every other application, the 570 shined. In Scratch, however, I ran into some really funky issues. And when I sent them my log files, they're like, you're using a card we don't support. And I was like, ooh, yeah, that's not a problem. And they're like, it is. And when I switched to the ATI, I got a 5870. It was remarkable. I mean, I didn't do anything other than change the card and all the problems went away. So my long story there is that even if the card is wonderful, if your application has some kind of particular requirement for Scratch, it's generally Quadros, although they are doing the ATI cards, actually, excuse me, the AMD cards to support Apple, you know, you might have to heed those regardless. Now, Resolve's wonderfully flexible, and I think that that's creating a killer ecosystem for cards for Resolve. So that's very cool.
Yeah, I'll say, I mean, there's other apps, for example, like the Adobe CS6 apps that have GPU acceleration that, you know, also require some modification in the application itself in order to be able to support the third-party GPUs, like the non-officially supported GPUs. But they do seem to work fine. And I know, I mean, I know several people who have, because of the work that we've done in terms of using PC cards in Resolve, have tried using them in the CS6 apps and had great success.
So how does your ATI card work in Resolve?
In terms of the 5870 for me, I you know what I did is I used Resolve 9 recently, and I was mostly just like everyone else playing with the new interface and learning how the you know, new features worked and stuff. And it was actually really nice. I think one of the greatest things, to be honest, is that it's wonderful that Resolve accepts a single card now. And the idea that you don't get that annoying, you don't have a dedicated GPU card, you know, boot error, you know. As much as it could work in the past, it's nice now that it officially is sort of supported. And so it's been good. You know, I have not tried Resolve 9 at this point with a dedicated, say, GT120 or whatever. And I have one. I guess I could have ripped out one of my other cards and tried it. But so far, if I wanted to use Resolve, I think I could get some work done with it. Definitely. So.
Yeah, there's people using like the built-in AMD cards in the iMacs to use, right, Resolve, and it works effectively. And I mean, even now there's like the new Retina, the MacBook Pro Retinas that actually have CUDA support, so they work really, really surprisingly well in Resolve.
You were able to try that, weren't you, Juan? How did that pan out? Because I haven't actually chatted with anybody in detail about the new Mac, the new MacBook Pro.
There's a couple of little quirks to it. One of them is an OS bug, it seems, like a graphics bug, where it just kind of something eats up all the GPU RAM, and you basically have to just change the screen resolution, then change it back to the 1920 1080 resolution in order to kind of clear out the RAM. And that usually kind of fixes that when you get the out of memory error. You know, you used to get when I tried it, it was on version 8 and then a beta of version 9. It was before they kind of added support for it. So I used to get a bunch of warnings about, you know, you don't have an optimized recommended GPU, and you don't have a proper CUDA device or things like that. But then it would actually work. So yeah, it seems to work, and I'm not using it anymore. That was just a test system, so I'm not using it anymore on that system. But we're actually looking at putting together a DIT station, and that would actually be based around the Retina, because it seemed to perform really well, and it works.
So we kind of talked about this on another podcast too. I think it's kind of related. Why is the Red Rocket's still so damn expensive? That's the other question. It's like, as long as we're on the subject of GPUs, because the Red Rocket is a GPU still, right?
It's not.
Is that what you would call it?
Well, it's not a graphical processing unit. It's simply a PU.
Okay.
Right. It's technically a DSP, right? Essentially, like a big, large scale integrated circuit, I guess, or sorry, like an ASIC.
I don't know what the actual chips involved are, but it's a rapid parallel processing unit that's designed specifically for the thing. I believe it's some kind of OEM card that they're actually chips that they're taking and putting on a board. So I don't think they've developed the chip, but don't quote me on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, you know, they are. I mean, they're charging, at the time when they developed it, it was kind of unique. The GPU was kind of in its infancy. GPU processing was in its infancy. And they came up with a solution that allowed people to work in incredibly high resolutions in real time. That was amazing. And $5,000, it was a bargain. It's just that nowadays, you know, you look at, you know, like, Jason, you mentioned, you know, you're doing F65 stuff in Scratch with an ATI card. You know, we're doing F65 stuff in Resolve with the NVIDIA cards, and it works like gangbusters. It's a non-issue. You know, you can, on a single GPU system, you're able to basically play back 4K material.
Yeah, the SDK, you know, and how efficient it is a big part of that. So it's possible, you know, with the effort.
Definitely. Yeah, and I find the same thing with Arri Raw too.
That's interesting, actually. I guess I actually saw a post of yours, Juan, where you described the idea of, I think, putting in 3 570s or 580s in a chassis. I haven't used that kind of setup to debare Red Raw. I mean, basically,
not Red Raw. Red Raw would not benefit from the the GPU.
So it's still CPU bound. That doesn't help you with
Red specifically, but you know you could put Red Rocket cards in, and you can chain those up. So if you needed to put two or three in to a system, you could do that.
Yeah, so that's the one thing, I guess, is I'm trying to think. Is it? It's true that the Red SDK doesn't allow you to offload to the GPU.
That is correct. Anyway. That is absolutely right. Yeah, okay. Right. Yes.
And just wondering if I missed something, but yeah, no, I mean, I guess that's the one thing is that, you know, like I said in another podcast, I am rendering literally right now on my Red Rocket, it was 480 gigs for a short that I'll be grading sometime soon here. Anyway, I'm just getting them their proxy media. And, you know, I mean, it's amazing. It chugs right along. It's completely 4 years old, but it does it. And but I'll say, I mean, I think that coming up in the future, let's say if this lasts another year or two, you know, it's going to probably become a bottleneck where they just need to address it somehow, some way, you know, a cheaper card or GPUs or something.
Yeah. Or I mean, if CPUs get faster and faster, you know, like now you're even like, I think in Premiere, people are playing back like half resolution Red files, CPU debared, I'm imagining, because nobody else is doing GPU debared, and they're getting real time playback on like 12 core max. So, and those are a couple of years old. So I think, you know, as CPUs get faster, that becomes more and more realistic.
Now, one thing that was interesting is some guys on Red User went, and I think it was Jeff Kilgrow and another gentleman, I can't remember his name, but he seemed to be equally technically capable. You know, they were both chatting back and forth. It was quite stimulating to see two geniuses talk. And essentially they were talking about building, I think it's something like the Intel i7, Xeon. I think it was a Xeon, like a 2790. I think that was the chip. Anyway, they're about $2,000 a piece. And these guys were essentially chatting about, and one of them was actually building a dual CPU machine. I believe they had a very good Supermicro motherboard and a very nice chassis, pretty much no expense spared. And they were chasing down full debare, you know, basically everything at highest settings.
Sure.
And that machine just barely eked it along to the point where it could do it. But overall, there would be, I believe the conclusion was there'd be nothing left to work with creatively, you know?
Right.
And so essentially that's, you know, $2,000 processors on about a $600 motherboard, you know, many other things nicely appointed. And so that's the thing that's weird. I think that little example there is what keeps people buying the Red Rocket because of the idea that you can have a Red Rocket or you can attempt to have this machine, which might be able to, you know, debayer at full resolution, but just barely. So probably I would say give it 2 more years or maybe 18 months if we're, you know, looking at Moore's Law.
Right. Well, here's my question to you. I mean, I've heard that there's a difference sometimes in the output from the Red Rocket card versus the CPU debayering.
I've heard about that too. Yeah. And actually the, you know, to be honest, I haven't done a tremendous number of experiments. What I'll say is that, you know, I've been satisfied with the Red Rocket's output, but there are a couple of things that the Red Rocket, is unable to do being hardware that software can do. And I think it has to do with, sharpening and, the way that the actual algorithm works on the Red Rocket versus if you were to apply it in software. So, I think there was an idea that in certain cases one would be softer than the other, but I can't remember clearly enough to speak to it right now. But yeah, there's a little difference, and under a microscope you might be able to take a look and find them.
Do you guys think that in order for Red to compete more, they need to drop the price of that? You know, I mean, if you think about the Scarlet and things like that too, I mean, they're getting into a lower end market as well. Do you think that it would help them to drop the price of the Red Rocket card, or do you think that it's fine the way it is?
I think a price drop there's no reason it would hurt, obviously. I think what would be nice is to see them open up the SDK and just let people debayer it on the GPU. Now, you know, the thing that kind of gets in the way of that is, you know, they for whatever reason, Red really prizes their codec, and they don't want to let anybody else have real access to their codec. Nobody else can write to their codec, and you know, they really restrict the reading of the codec, the proper decoding of the codec. So I think they think it's a really valuable IP asset, and they don't want to kind of let it out in that way.
You know what? That's a great point. I would almost bet that that's more important than whether or not they're making money on the Red Rocket. That they control the writing of the R3Ds and out to, you know, other formats.
At least they allow you to trim it now.
That's interesting. I mean, I guess, you know, on so many fronts, a lot of this stuff that we're dealing with right now is the last 3 years. And it seems like CPU-wise, GPU-wise, display-wise, you know, like the second-gen OLEDs that'll hopefully be coming, you know, how people are treating, you know, basically there was a thought that over the past few years that if you wanted to do, let's say, high-end color grading, that required a very expensive proprietary suite. That's becoming more and more open. It feels like we're on the pivot point of a new era on so many different fronts. And things like letting the SDK go and all that will contribute to a software world as opposed to a hardware one.
Do you guys see more things other than Red these days? Or are you still kind of bent towards just Red work?
I see a ton of Alexa.
Alexa out there these days too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. I mean lot. I'm much more than Red, actually. I see very little Red, to tell you the truth. Other than from people that own the camera, I don't see a lot of rentals for Red where people like needed a kit for a day and they went with Red. I see that those guys go F3, Sony F3. I see a lot of Alexa.
Yeah, I really would have thought when the Scarlet hit, we would have saw a lot more Red too.
I've got to say, I am seeing it.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. No. Well, how about this? And I think it speaks a lot to the markets that we all work in, which is really fun because I think that adds a lot to what we can speak to.
Are you going to make this like an East Coast, West Coast thing, Jason?
Yeah, West Side represent. anyway, yeah. No, the idea would be I am really fundamentally doing a lot of indie shorts and features, and it's Red 24/7. And then for the people that don't have, let's say a budget over 20,000, you know, gosh, just speaking to all of it, you know, they're doing say 5D or maybe C300. But the big deal is that everybody who gets a budget, at least on what I'm working on, I'm not saying I represent LA in any way or whatever, but you know, it's Scarlet. Actually, I have two friends who are DPs who just invested in Scarlets, and they are working 24/7. I mean, they are cranking. I'm actually in admiration of them with the way that they've made a very educated decision as to what camera to buy in a world right now where there are so many cameras that you could choose from. I mean, you know, what do you buy if you're a cinematographer? And both of them went and they got Scarlett's. They spent about $20,000, I think, for their total packages, and they are gone every day. So, you know, it's interesting to see how it evolves. But I know in the broadcast world, it's Alexa all day long, and then there's lots of room in there for the F65 and all sorts of stuff, especially at the very high end. So.
Yeah, I'm curious about that. I think maybe your experience is like indicative of, you know, you made an investment in the Red Rocket. You sort of made a commitment to Red. And so maybe that's a reason you're seeing so much Red stuff is because it's a little bit of a self-selection. You know what I mean? Like people are like, oh, people who need Red work go to you because they know you have the Red Rocket. They know you know the workflow. They know you have the experience with Red.
Yeah, even when the Red 1 came out, whole facilities were built around the fact that you could work with Red Media.
Right, sure. Right. Yeah. But what I'll say is just to clarify for my own stance in a way, I kind of place myself in the market. You know, I'm not what I'll call, you know, dyed in the wool, you know, Red user, you know, poster every day. You know, I have some friends who are, and, you know, they wear the shirts and, you know, they have the accessories and the coffee mug and all that stuff. And so, you know, I'll be honest, it'd be really fun if there was more Alexa at the indie, film level that, you know, I'm working at. I tell you, a lot of people talk about it, but at the end of the day, for whatever reason, I think it might be an availability thing. I think that for right now, there's a little bit more saturation of Red among the places that one could rent. And I don't know if you get necessarily what I'd call the really good deal on an Alexa that you might be able to pull off with the Red. I mean, there are some DPs out there that are just to, you know, keep working, you know, will, you know, cut you quite a deal now that there are a number of Red cameras out there. And I think what is the current count of Alexas? It's like 2,500 in the world right now. So, you know, that's still a small enough amount that they're not diluting the market. And I think that if you want an Alexa, you got to pay a daily rate that's still very good, you know.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the demand for Alexa is really high in sort of the high-end world, and they can spend more. So they get sort of first dibs on those totally. Packages. And then the other thing is that the DPs that have experience in the film world and are really in-demand DPs, they're drawn to Alexa because it's very, very similar to them. It's really accessible to them, and they like the way it feels. They like the way it responds.
It's a camera. It feels like a camera, not, you know, a square box, you know, so totally. I think that an Alexa is what a lot of people who are transitioning from film are going to be most comfortable with. And I think that Arri, by respecting that, is getting a lot of outstanding traction. And the other big thing, we talked about this in another podcast, I think they're really smart. A couple things. They focused on image quality, the dynamic range, which allows you to just really get it done. And then the other thing is that there's a practical nature with it. You got Arri RAW, and then you have the ProRes or DNX HD output. And I swear, I really think that if Red were to do one thing that would really help a lot is to offer that, just a bolt-on, a module, or something, you know, offer a way to get high-quality proxies made without necessarily forcing people to pay the Red post-tax, you know, so.
There's a really good question, actually, that I've seen come up a lot, too, is there any benefit to working with Arri RAW versus the ProRes version of it?
Yeah.
Have you guys used either or?
Yeah, the Arri RAW stuff's significantly sharper. The ProRes is great. I mean, if you're doing HD work, like if you're going to end up in HD, the ProRes is perfect because the workflow is just so easy. And the dynamic range is great, and the quality is very good. I mean, excellent. It's not very good. It's spectacular quality. The Arri RAW just takes it to like another level in terms of sharpness. So it's great and wonderful to work with. And the Latitude, I think, is pretty much the same in terms of what you get with the Log-C ProRes stuff versus the Arri RAW. I haven't seen anybody record DNX HD on the Arri yet. I have not seen that come in. I know that's floating around out there, but it seems like that hasn't really caught on in the way that the ProRes workflow did. But
you know what the really interesting thing is that I've been working on a bunch of different sort of workflows for myself. You know, when people come to me and they say, hey, I want to edit in Avid or Final Cut or whatever, even Premiere, I actually like on Twitter, you know, I've got to prepare for my first Premiere grade. And so the thing that's so funny is that I have a couple friends that edit in Avid. I'm doing a short film coming up, and they said to me, we're going to edit in Avid, but you can just give us ProRes. And so there's this odd thought. I found it kind of interesting with exactly what you just said, but many of them are using ProRes as sort of the transportation format from place to place. And then they are linking to it and ingesting it, you know, with the idea that ProRes is now sort of a natively supported format in Media Composer 6. And so to hear the Avid, you know, my Avid friends go and say, hey, you know, just give me ProRes. It was sort of surreal. And but they swear, they're like, this is fine. This is good. You know, we don't care. We'll use that. And then we'll make MXF from that and on we'll go. So.
Yeah, it's fast. It's universal. It's the mastering format, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, to bring it back full circle too, with the Airy RAW, you could still benefit from using any GPU that you choose rather than a RAW format like RED. You still have to rely on a RED Rocket card.
Correct. So, I mean, right now, you know, let's kind of break this down a little bit. So, you know, when you're dealing with a QuickTime file or a DNxHD file, that's a very simple kind of mathematical algorithm to decode that into a space that your system can work on. And that's called a codec. And, you know, it's decoded on the CPU, and just about any CPU can handle that pretty effectively. When you're dealing with these raw camera formats, you're dealing with a much more complicated issue of debayering, which is basically like interpreting what the color should be from the pixels around one pixel or another. And that's a really mathematically complex problem. And it's something that's great done in a vast number of parallel processors, because one pixel can be calculated at the same time as another pixel is being calculated. Red Rocket is a form of parallel processing designed specifically for the RED code, but a lot of these other RAW formats, the Airy RAW format, the F65 RAW format, and even the new Cinema DNG format that the Blackmagic Cinema camera is going to be using, allow for the debayering to take place on a GPU, provided that the software development kit, the SDK that has been developed to decode those formats, allows the processing to be offset onto a GPU, a graphic processing unit. And that happens very, very quickly, much faster and much more efficiently than when it would happen in your CPU, your central processing unit.
I think one of the things that's really interesting too is to see how OpenCL evolves as well. I was just at SIGGRAPH, and so one of the things is that there's a lot of talk right now about the coming years. Actually, I was able to talk with some guys at a place called I think it was called CodePlay. There's some gentlemen from England, and the guy that I talk with, he basically writes compilers all day, and compiler being, you know, the piece of software that takes your human instructions, you know, like your C++ or C# or whatever, and turns it into the binary machine code that a cell phone, for instance, might use. And one of the big hot markets actually for GPU, in chatting with these guys who are very brilliant and fun to talk with, was the idea that GPU acceleration is now becoming really popular all over the place. So we're using it on our level, but imagine a cell phone with something like a camera app is using it for sharpening, for Adobe like blur removal, you know. So have you guys seen the, there was a very cool NAB demo in Photoshop where you had a blurred image and it was able to interpolate it back toward what it was when it was sharp. It was really quite effective, sort of a vector processing.
Yep.
And people are doing that in phones now to make shaky camera pictures sharp. And so that's all OpenCL, and to an extent, I believe there might be CUDA implementations, but really a lot of that charge based on openness is being led by OpenCL. And so I was talking to this gentleman, I said, hey, can you give me an idea of where CUDA sits with OpenCL? And actually, maybe a year ago, I remember there was something about OpenCL being about 25% as efficient as CUDA. And that's just anecdotal. I remember hearing that in a discussion. But one of the things he said is he said they're going to reach parity in terms of efficiency, you know, pound for pound, very soon. And so it's going to be interesting to see as OpenCL becomes efficient and is potent, let's say, how that little divide is going to either allow, you know, CUDA some sort of competition or where it will start to permeate, because it's already being used in cell phones, you know, so.
Yeah, I mean, OpenCL is has a tremendous potential and is really, from the consumer perspective, even professional consumers, a great step, because it means that, you know, the same code that's being run on one graphics card will be able to run on another graphics card, which is not necessarily the case today. As Jason, you know, Jason realized, you know, you couldn't run that scratch code on that GTX card, and Resolve doesn't run as well on an AMD card as it does on an NVIDIA card. So right now there's some heavy optimization that's being done for particular graphics cards for those programs and every other program that uses graphics cards. But in the future, hopefully, you know, everybody standardizes on OpenCL, and then you can just pick the best card for your system, the fastest card, and you don't have to worry about whether it's optimized for your program or not, the application that you want to use, because every application will be using OpenCL, will be using the same code base to get the job done.
Yeah, and that's why that gentleman, you know, with CodePlay, you know, he's very busy writing compilers. So he said literally he was doing something for Qualcomm. So, for instance, Qualcomm has a chipset. They want to support, you know, these features, and he's writing a compiler for them so that they are able to code for their phones, you know, and, you know, multiply that by every device out there that would like compatibility. And so I think one of the big things that NVIDIA has to take a look at, and I believe CUDA is really wonderful. I mean, it's carried us a tremendous distance in terms of enhancing our ability as, you know, as creative, you know, artists. But one of the big things will be NVIDIA will have to, actually in a positive sense, probably, you know, continue to add to their, you know, value equation in terms of how CUDA can help people. And this is just, you know, a little bit of hearsay, but, the word on the floor, so to speak, was that NVIDIA might not be supporting OpenCL in their cards coming up. And so that's sort of a battle line they might be drawing, with the idea that they actually think that OpenCL is an honest threat now. So, you know, I wish it would be everybody getting along together, but then again, everybody's bottom lines have to be defended. And NVIDIA, I hear, is going to be doing that by dropping OpenCL support in their cards. So that's going to be an interesting new thing for us to deal with on our end, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it doesn't come to that. That may be a bit of posturing or a bit of the old rumor mill, you know, churning away. I think it's in their interest to support, have robust support for OpenCL, just as they have robust support for CUDA, with CUDA being the more kind of processing focused platform, you know, for really heavy duty. You know, CUDA's used in the, like, scientific applications quite a bit. Like, you know, if you're doing like genetic analysis, or you're doing like molecular simulations, those run spectacularly on CUDA hardware. So it has these like very sort of industrial and focused applications. And so I think CUDA has a future regardless of what happens with OpenCL. As a consumer, I'd like to see, you know, strong OpenCL support across all platforms, so that I'm able to pick the best card for my situation. I think, you know, we've had great experiences with the NVIDIA cards, and there's been some great ATI cards and AMD cards available on the Macs and on PCs, you know, that really is the future now of computing. People. You know, I know a lot of people who are running 4 or 5 year old Mac Pro systems and just upgrading the graphics card, and they're going, "Wow, it's like I have a whole new computer because I upgraded the graphics card." Because so much is done on that graphics card.
Yeah, we really have to give a lot of thanks to all those guys who played games on their PCs, because that's what drove the whole thing. That's like basically what made all of these GPUs happen. That thousands and thousands of kids playing video games demanded more frames per second, and
kids and young professionals with expendable income that were willing to spend, you know, $2,000-$3,000 on putting together a beefed up computer so they could play you know, Unreal Tournament or whatever.
Yeah, their relentless pursuit of 16 by anti-aliasing is benefiting the world at large. So yeah, no, totally. I mean, that's absolutely true, because they represented a body of consumers, a market. They represented a market that allowed that development to happen. And do you guys remember like the ATI Rage 128s, you know, with the little heat sinks? I mean, you know, we probably had those, you know, if you guys ever had a beige Mac, or if you had a, you know, a PC back in the day.
here's how old I am. I had a I had a graphics card that actually like was it was like a graphics processor that was like a annex card onto a regular VGA card.
So oh, you would, I had like, one of those too. You had a Voodoo. Are you talking about a Voodoo?
Yeah, was it a Voodoo?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's no pain greater than having to set IRQ or DMA settings on card.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, that's bringing back memories. I remember that. I think, I can't remember what the game was, but I think it was like Myst or something that the Voodoo allowed me to play that game, and it was 3D, and it was the first time I ever saw what I'll call an actually, it was one of those games where you, you know, control armies and stuff. I can't remember, but long story short is that, yeah, the Voodoo was so funny because you would port your rage or whatever into it, and then out of that would go to your display. Hell yeah.
and then all of a sudden it was awesome. I guess it was just drawing the window that the image was on, but that's, yeah, that's amazing technology. Yeah. And it's amazing how far we've come now, where we have these incredible supercomputers on a graphics card, and we're able to get them for, you know, cents on the dollar on what they would have cost not too long ago.
Yeah, now you're able to play Myst on your phone.
Exactly. That's true. So on that note, I guess we should wrap this up here. You know, big thanks to the gamers out there. Keep playing. We appreciate it.
We do.
I'm Juan Salvo, a colorist and an online editor in New York City. You can find me at juansalvo.com, and I'm on Twitter at j_salvo.
And I'm Jason Myers. I'm a colorist and post-production engineer in Los Angeles. You can find me on LiftGamma Gain and on Twitter under Jason Myers.
And I'm Josh Petok. You can find me on the Twitters as well at Josh Petok. And I'm also around LiftGamma Gain as well. Thanks for joining us, and we will see you on the next episode.